This is Paul Hurt and Jennifer Sweeney of Arizona State University interviewing Jan Balsam, Senior Advisor to the Superintendent of Grand Canyon National Park, on September 7th of 2018. It's about 2:30 p.m. Jan, thanks for sitting with us today.
It is my pleasure to welcome you to Grand Canyon National Park, and my humble office is up here in Park Headquarters.
Thanks. So if you would start out by telling us your position, all the positions that you've held in the Adaptive Management Program and the years that you participated in it.
Within the Glen Canyon Dam Adaptive Management Program, I actually began working on issues related to Glen Canyon Dam and its effects on the resources of Grand Canyon prior to the Grand Canyon Enlargement Act being passed in 1992. I started working as an archaeologist in the Grand Canyon, as a student, actually, of Arizona State University, a graduate student, and working up at Grand Canyon on my thesis back in the early 80s, and ended up on the river in 1982, 83, 84. And 1983 is when we had the large releases from Glen Canyon Dam.
El Nino year.
Big water that came down starting in July and continued for quite a while after that. And as an archaeologist for the park at that point in time, I was still a student, and I became the park archaeologist during that period of time. I was one of the ones who discovered a lot of the archaeological sites that had been washed out after the high water started to recede in 83, and then in 84, 85, we had still a lot of high water, 45,000, 50,000, 60,000, and acre feet per second that were traveling through the canyon, and we started seeing more and more archaeological sites that were eroding and had been affected in some way, shape, or form by those higher flows. So as the archaeologist for the park at that point in time, I'd finished my work at Arizona State. I was working up at Grand Canyon full-time as the park's archaeologist starting in May of 1984. And that was prior to the initiation of any of the programs, per se. The Glen Canyon Environmental Studies, GCES, had begun in 1982. So this was 2 years into that program. And the original GCES program was established to evaluate the effects of low and fluctuating flows on the resources below Glen Canyon Dam. And here we are in 1983, 1984, 1985, with not low and fluctuating flows, but really high, steady flows. So a lot of the research that was initially designed to evaluate low and fluctuating wasn't appropriate anymore because they had high, steady flows. So we were seeing impacts downstream that a lot of the research wasn't capturing, but the scientists working within that program adjusted accordingly to try to start documenting some of those activities. And at that point in time, a fellow named Dave Wegner, who was the lead for Bureau Reclamation's GCES program, had contacted the park about what kind of studies we thought we needed to include within the GCES program at the time. And looking at the archaeological resources was a big piece of it. Looking at the effects to recreation was a big piece of it. So those two components were really key for us getting involved in those early years of the GCES program. You fast forward to 1989, we have Secretary of the Interior at the time, Manuel Lujan, identified the need to do an environmental impact statement on the operations of Glen Canyon Dam. And it was the sort of thing that wasn't normally done. They had never done an EIS on an existing facility. So they're starting with a program they hadn't really done, they didn't really know, but the public pressure was huge. Recreational boaters on the Colorado River and Grand Canyon were sitting on beaches watching the water come up and down because they operated the dam at a way they called a cash register dam, but when people turned on their lights, they would let more water out. When people turned off their lights, they would stop the water flow. So you had wide fluctuations that would be in the neighborhood of 20 to 30,000 cubic feet per second changes in a day that would result in 10 or 15 feet downstream of stage change that would leave boats high and dry or wash camps away in the middle of the night. So you had both ends, and I think I got to participate in both ends of that. Boats being high and dry and also boats floating into your camp in the middle of the night. Wow. So all of those things were in play at that time, And as archaeologist for the park, I was most concerned about looking at the archaeological resources and how the dam flows were affecting the integrity of those properties. So 1989 comes around, Lujan identifies the need for an environmental impact statement, and the Department of the Interior agencies and Department of Energy, Western Area Power Administration, identified individuals from their staffs who would be tasked with helping to write the environmental impact statement and do the analysis of effects of dam operations. So as the park's archaeologist, I then became a member of the EIS writing team for the Glen Canyon Dam environmental impact statement that was done. In combination with that, we had to begin doing the archaeological inventory survey then of the Colorado River corridor, and I was the principal investigator with a staff that included Helen Fairley, Peter Bungard, Chris Coder, Jim Huffman, a few other folks who are our crew leads. And we spent the better part of 9 months with the crews working under a cooperative agreement with Northern Arizona University to do the 100% inventory of the river corridor. That resulted in documenting 475 properties in the nearshore environment from the dam down to the lake that were potentially affected.
Traditional cultural properties?
Archaeological sites. Archaeological okay. sites. It was really in the early 90s, the concept of what a traditional cultural property wasn't quite fleshed out. Mm-hmm. The identifications that of how to go about documenting those are still in flux. They're still not well understood. Mm-hmm. But at that point in time, we were strictly focused on what are the archaeological resources. And a piece of that was bringing our tribal colleagues down onto the Colorado mm-hmm. River so that they could help us design the research module, how we were going to do this, mm-hmm. so that they understood what we were looking for and that we could understand from them things that we may need to be looking for. And it was the first time, and I didn't realize this at the time, but it was the first time that anybody had done a river trip where we had invited the traditionally associated people back into the canyon. And that led to a whole other legacy of the tribe's involvement. But the very first trip was in 1990, where we had tribal people and archaeologists working for the tribes on the river with us to evaluate sort of what the environment looked like and how we were going to structure the survey.
And this was a joint trip between the tribes and NPS, mm-hmm. or the tribes and...
Tribes and the Park Service.
And the Park Service. And that was 1990, and that was the first time you'd done it. They're annual trips now, aren't they?
They are.
Or actually more than once a year.
Depends on which one, on which tribe, but yeah. But that was the very first time we'd done an intertribal, multi-tribal trip. It was the first time anybody had done anything like that. And I was young enough and naive enough, I didn't realize that I was doing something that hadn't been done before. It seemed like the logical thing to do at the time.
Let me get the chronology straight. Was it before that or during that year that you did the 100% survey and identified the 400 and some sites?
It was, we started the survey probably, I'm going to say 2 months after we did the intertribal trip.
Okay.
So pretty much we'd identified we were going to do it. We brought all of our tribal colleagues down to look at the area with us. And then we set our crews out to start actually walking the length of the mm-hmm. Colorado River.
And those subsequent trips that did the actual surveys, did any tribal members participate in those?
We didn't have tribal participants on the survey trips themselves. We pretty much were hiring archaeologists through the university that walked the entire corridor through the winter months. It was all ore-supported. There was a lot mm-hmm. of suggestions that we could do the job much quicker and cost less if we use motorboats. Mm. The Grand Canyon is a proposed wilderness, and looking at minimum tool requirements, we couldn't justify the use of motorboats, especially because our crews were walking. They weren't trying to get down quickly. So we structured it with our crews, and pretty much over an 8-month period of time, they walked the entire corridor and recorded all of the archaeological sites that could be seen at that point in time. We've added some since then mm-hmm. Because other sites have become uncovered, but that's formed the basis of the inventory of the river corridor, and a lot of the work that's been done subsequent was based on those surveys from 90 to 92.
Can you estimate, out of curiosity for me, can you estimate about what percentage of those sites that you all documented in those early years were actually being affected by river flow fluctuations, and what percentage were, you know, higher and outside that flow regime?
So when you look at the effects to an archaeological site, you're looking at direct and indirect and cumulative. So you can't only look at those that were in the flood zone, per se, those from, like, up to the way the power plant capacity was only like 30,000. So you can't really use that as a guide, because at 30,000, if you're eroding sediment, everything above it starts to fall down.
Slide down,
so you can't just... So when we did the survey, we kept the survey corridor to the area that was sand, that was all part of the pre-dam alluvial terrace.
Okay.
So the survey went from the current river up to about the 120,000 cubic feet per second line, and that's where the mesquite zone is. That's where you can clearly see the river terraces. And people, being people, always lived along rivers, especially if they had them available, and it was no different here. And I think for us, the early archaeologists who went down the canyon, and the first one was in the 1950s who had documented it, he had said that there was little evidence of people living along the Colorado River. And in the 1960s, there was a number of excavations done by the School of American Research at a number of sites along the river. Unkar Delta and Bright Angel were the two most well-known. And they found that people were indeed living along the river, and that a lot of those sites, it turns out, were just inundated. They were buried by sand, by pre-dam flooding. So up until 1963, annual flooding would have covered everything. So the archaeologists who went down in 1958, they didn't see it because it was under sand. They wouldn't have seen it. They couldn't have seen it. So it makes perfect sense in hindsight to say it. It's not that they were bad archaeologists. It wouldn't have been visible, because every year you would have these big floods that would just cover everything over and make a new floodplain. It's only when you stop the sediment supply that those things start becoming available and to see. And that's the legacy that we're looking at, is all of those things, from all of those thousands of years of people living along the river. And they, every year they would come back. There would be a flood. They come back. They plant. They do whatever. You know, next year it would flood again. They come back. There's a new flat surface because everything is buried in sand again. Every year was an annual cycle. And it just kept happening for thousands of years until 1963, and then that stopped.
And that's when Glen Canyon Dam was completed, and the gates closed, and the lake filled.
And the lake filled, and sediment was trapped upstream. So you've got a different in the dynamic of the system at that point in time. And that changed the stability and the preservation of the river terraces that are along the river, and the sort of the dynamic of the ecosystem.
That was beautifully described.
Thank you.
I could visualize. I've been on the Unkar Delta.
Oh, yeah.
And was super impressed.
Yeah.
And I'm very surprised. Now I'm trying to imagine it completely covered in sand.
Yeah.
And then subsequently, over the years of erosion, starting to reveal all of
right.
the...
So you've got the delta and the areas that are up top, but then if you go off the delta down towards the river, you've got a whole bunch of sand dunes down there, and lo and behold, there's archaeological remains all through that area. But again, Doug Schwartz wouldn't have seen that, because it was still... He was doing excavations there just a couple years after they closed the gates of the dam. So there was still all big sand dunes.
So one of the things we'll talk a lot about today is the integration of tribal representatives into this program over time. And I want to go back to you mentioning the surveys that you did early on. The tribes were involved in thinking about that research project and helping design it. But not involved in the actual site surveys, but I'm sure that they were very curious about what you discovered. Can you talk just a little bit about how you shared the results of those site surveys with your tribal representatives, and the kinds of concerns that they had, and how you continued to integrate them over time into that research study, and then, you know, later on the adaptive management program?
So working with the tribes on the archaeology and in the survey, I mean, it it seems funny. I mean, it was the early 1990s. It wasn't that long ago. Mm-hmm. But there wasn't a lot of integration of archaeologists with tribes anywhere. I mean, we had the National Historic Preservation Act in 1966. I mean, we had a number of legal structures that were set up. But in terms of the on-the-ground working with tribes, there wasn't a whole lot of that going on. When we began this project and started looking at how we were going to do the survey, and I'm going to back up and say that in addition to being the park archaeologist at the time, I also was the park's tribal liaison, and also was in charge of the Section 106 compliance for the park, which meant any time we were going to have an action that has the potential to affect a resource of a concern to one of the tribes, it was our responsibility to consult with them. So, and I had started as taking on the role of the tribal liaison when we were doing a project to build a parking lot up on the East Rim, and we had an archaeological site there. I knew enough from my studies that and working at the State Historic Preservation Office that we needed to contact the tribes, sent out letters to all of the known tribes. We had five at the time that we worked with.
You have 13 now, right?
11, just 11.
Okay.
No, only 11. So we sent out letters to the five tribes that we work with, and the entire Havasupai Tribal Council showed up in the superintendent's office.
Wow.
And the superintendent at the time was a fellow named Jack Davis. He looked at me and he said, "I think we need to have somebody who does tribal liaison. I guess that will be you." And so I added that to my portfolio of responsibilities. So we started working along the river, and we knew that there was enough, the archaeology was pretty extraordinary, even the limited amount that we knew about. We contacted the tribes early on, let them know we were going to be doing this, got them engaged with at least that portion of the project. And also, as we began moving towards the environmental impact statement, Lujan identified in 1989 we're going to do this EIS. We started having an EIS writing team, and upon the insistence of a couple of us, we convinced Bureau of Reclamation that they needed to include the tribes as part of the cooperating agencies, part of the writing team, because these are resources of concern to the tribes, not just to us as the National Park Service or to the American public, who we're all responsible to. But even at that time, we knew the Hopi, for example, have significant histories in the canyon. The Navajo border the river for 60-plus miles. The Havasupai, the Hualapai to the west, we knew that they have ancestral areas, the Southern Paiute to the north. So, you know, we worked with Reclamation. It wasn't something they had ever done, and it was challenged them a little bit to think about a different way of inclusion. Mm-hmm. We were fortunate that it was... Bruce Babbitt was Secretary of the Interior for a good portion of this, after Lujan and change of administrations, the Clinton administration, that there was more acceptance of the tribal perspectives. There were a number of executive orders that were issued during those years as well that instructed federal agencies to consult with tribes on a more meaningful level, government-to-government relations. So there was a lot of things within our governmental structures, societal structures, that pointed to us working more with tribes. And so at that point in time, the legal mandates were there as federal agencies, the recognition within our society of those needs were there. So it provided us leverage to make sure that the tribal voices were heard. So on that initial writing team, in addition to the biologists, the archaeologists that you had from the agencies, you had the archaeologists from the Hopi tribe, you had the archaeologists from the Hualapai tribe, you had the archaeologists from the Navajo Nation. And they were archaeologists, but also cultural specialists. So that all of a sudden you have a group that's not just sort of the Western National Environmental Policy Act, we're going to write a NEPA document. You had representatives from Hopi, Hualapai, and Navajo on that initial writing team. So, and that was a real shift for them. And I think the tribes have all come to expect it. I think it was a real shift for Reclamation, who was not necessarily comfortable with going that route. But they kind of got kind of forced into it, I guess.
Their arms twisted a little bit.
I think it was too much of a public program to try to exclude the tribes who've called mm-hmm. this canyon home for thousands of years.
So. You've mentioned a couple of times some inertia or resistance on the part of traditional agencies and land managers to incorporating tribes. Was there any resistance on the part of the tribes? Because I know there's a certain amount of distrust or sort of lack of relationships. As you were saying, there hadn't been good relationships between a lot of the professions and some government agencies and the tribes. So I imagine, you know, that it was difficult to begin to bring these people together into a cooperative working relationship. Can you talk a little bit about that dynamic?
You know, it's funny when you think about some of the political discord between the agencies, the federal approach to Indian law and policy, the differences amongst the tribes in terms of land base and resources and a lot of those things. But for whatever reason, when you talk about the Grand Canyon, everybody comes together because wow. they all have common histories here. There's a recognition that everyone has a vested interest in ensuring that this place continues. So I think that because of the place and the way in which we included the tribes from the very beginning, with the archaeological survey saying, we understand that this is your history, we want you to help us preserve these things, that it was a general opening to all of them to participate with us, and that followed through into the formal NEPA process as them being part of the writing team. And it was something, again, that hadn't been done before, and I think at this point it's expected. It's I don't think we can close the door on that one. We need to include all of them. And, you know, within this process we were also providing funding for tribal specialists. One of the problems we see is that the tribes are asked to participate without any financial compensation. And it's not like everybody is independently wealthy or they have other jobs that they can go back to. I mean, we're asking for their expertise to help us with this. And just like all of us are on salary, they needed to be too. So it really did shift things because all of a sudden they were recognized as the subject matter experts in these arenas. And, you know, Hopi wrote the Hopi section of the EIS. They did the evaluation of how the river flows were affecting their properties. Hmm. You know, each one of the tribes, and at that point, Zuni came into our fold of interested tribes. We didn't know about Zuni's history at Grand Canyon until partway through this process. And all of a sudden, Zuni is now a part of this discussion as well. And three different Southern Paiute bands were added to the dialogue. So we keep expanding, and in a lot of ways, there's some suggestion that these folks don't necessarily have the same claims. Mm-hmm. It's not by the other tribal groups, but outside groups who are looking at how we consult. And my answer typically has been, it's not that much fun to work with a federal agency, so if you don't have that kind of interest, you're not going to want to get that kind of paperwork. So the interest that we've gotten from all of the tribes and their continued engagement over all these years speaks to the deep history and connection to the land. And that continues today.
Was it as easy to get the various tribes involved as stakeholders once the formal adaptive management program was set up and the adaptive management working group was set up?
So the process of establishing the adaptive management working group, so the Grand Canyon Protection Act was passed in 1992, and I will say that I was one of the ones sitting in an office downstairs faxing suggested text language to the committee staff.
Cool.
Which is why cultural resources is part of the Grand Canyon Protection Act. It hadn't been before I got to see it.
Wow.
And as the cultural manager here at the time, and it's like, wait a minute, it can't just be natural resources and recreation. What about thousands of years of history here? Yeah. So cultural resources got added to the bulk of the majority, the 1802, the section of the Grand Canyon Protection Act that speaks to what, you know, that we're going to, you know, mitigate adverse impacts to and improve the conditions for which Grand Canyon and Glen Canyon were established, including but not limited to natural and cultural resources and visitor uses. So all of those pieces got put into place, and we had to recognize that historic properties, archaeological sites, and at the time I was really focused on archaeological sites. Over the years I realized that that was kind of limiting, that cultural resources, and I'm glad I use that word at the time, because it's more inclusive. Mm-hmm. And certainly of the tribe's interest. Because archaeology is one piece, but the other piece is the traditional cultural values that the tribes place on the landscape and within the Grand Canyon. So it's kind of good that it was a much broader. Mm-hmm. So in 1992, you've got the Grand Canyon Protection Act that says we're going to do all of these great things. Agencies, Secretary of the Interior, you are required to finish the CIS within 2 years of the passage of the law, which we didn't quite make, but we were close. We finished the draft in 95. The record of decision was signed in 96. And once that was done, one of the environmental commitments in the record of decision was to establish the adaptive management program. So the tribes had been cooperating agencies on the EIS, so it transferred fairly straightforward mm-hmm. into them being a part of the adaptive management work group. The other part of that, in the law, it identified who the stakeholders were going to be. And it includes the seven basin states, the tribes, the affiliated tribes, power and water interests, recreation, blah, blah, blah. So it actually included all of that in the act. So they were built in, and it was a requirement to consult with them.
Were specific tribes mentioned?
I would have to go back and read the act. I think it was just presumed that the regional tribes, the tribes that had been a part of this, it may well have mentioned them by name, but I would have to go back and actually look.
Can you rattle off the 11? You mentioned five already.
Yeah, Havasupai, Hopi, Wallapai, Navajo, Kaibab Paiute, San Juan Southern Paiute, Las Vegas Paiute, Paiute Indian Tribe of Utah, Yavapai Apache. Stop that. So of all of the tribes, we've got the various Southern Paiute groups, including the Paiute Indian Tribe of Utah, and then, of course, the Pueblo Zuni in New Mexico, that make up our 11 consulting tribes.
For Grand Canyon National Park. For 11 consulting tribes.
And of those, the Kaibab Paiute, the Paiute Indian Tribe of Utah, the Las Vegas Moapa, that whole group of Southern Paiutes north of the Colorado River, consult together as a group as mm-hmm. the Southern Paiute Consortium. The San Juan Southern Paiute have not ever been particularly interested. The Havasupai have not. They were part of the original cooperating agencies, but they haven't actively participated in the monitoring or mitigation work. Their interests are a little different. The Wallapai have been very active because they abound the area for 108 miles of the south side of the river. Mm-hmm. Navajo to the east, the first 60-plus miles. And the Hopi and Zuni have actually been the most engaged. And I think it speaks to the level of their ancestral interests in Grand Canyon. Mm. So that most of what we see and the most of the recommendations come from them and then the Southern Paiute groups, because you kind of look at the place names in Grand Canyon as a good indication when you have places like Nankaweap, Toroweap, Quaggut, they're all Paiute words. And it speaks to that history. And we know that there are places in the canyon that are significant for their histories that are different than some of the other groups. So each group, each government, each cultural identity is represented somewhere different, but there is a shared understanding of the importance of Grand Canyon as part of all of the traditional landscapes for the native peoples of the area.
And for the time that you've been involved in the adaptive management program, have all of those tribes consistently participated, or are there a handful that are more dedicated to participation over the long term?
You know, I think participation by the tribes in all of this is really based on very specific interests that they have and also the realities of allocations of their own time and money. Mm-hmm. The Zuni, the Hopi, the Wallapai, the Navajo, and the Paiute, those five have been consistently involved, and they continue to stay involved. But it's difficult because, mm-hmm. like I mentioned before, I mean, we're all funded to participate in this. Mm-hmm. The tribes, and they may have a representative, but the representative from Zuni who attends the meetings has to go back and speak with the religious advisors and the council. And so those people aren't getting paid. So there's got to be some way that the information that they have and the evaluations that they do, that they're compensated for that work, because it is we, the federal agencies, who are asking them for it. within the Grand Canyon Protection Act, there is a presumption that the ongoing monitoring and mitigation will provide improvement, benefit to the resource. And certainly from a tribal perspective, only you as a tribal member can know if the traditional resource that you are concerned about is doing okay. Is it? Does it need help? Is it still as functional as it was? Are the spring sources that you rely on for a traditional purpose still functioning the way they have, or have there been a change? And only you would know that. So it's important for the traditional people to be able to come down and evaluate within their expertise how well a specific resource is adjusting to this changed environment. And that's been the focus point for us as to how the tribe's continued participation has helped us be better managers and better stewards, because they're the only ones who know if this resource is responding correctly. And it's and they each have their own view as to how to evaluate that. For some tribes, you know, it's the religious leaders. For others, it's youth and trying to orient them to have a sense of place of where their ancestors came from. But all of that is part and parcel of the experiences of being within the Grand Canyon and being part of the canyon. And it's a continuum, and there's no one answer. And it will shift over time. I mean, Glen Canyon Dam was finished in 1963, so you've got 50-some years now of an experiment, essentially. And many of our tribal colleagues will remind me that they're patient people. They're just going to wait. Every dam that's ever gone on the Colorado River has been eroded around. We just haven't taken a long enough perspective. But we also, as federal agencies, have responsibility to preserve in perpetuity. I mean, the National Park Service in particular, we're the, you know, we're the forever people. You know, these resources are our responsibility forever. As long as the Park Service exists, we will see ourselves as the stewards for these lands. And we're stewards not for our own selves, but for the American people and the tribal groups who have called this, again, this canyon home for thousands of years. And we take that responsibility really seriously.
You're the third or the fourth person that we've interviewed who's mentioned this issue of financing, of participation. And I remember seeing a memo from one of the tribal representatives a few months back saying that he would not be able to make it to the next meeting because funding wasn't available and that more funding was needed to really engage tribal members and other participants. Can you talk a little bit more, because nobody has really discussed this in any of the interviews we've done before. What is the sort of compensation mechanism for participants in the program, and how has compensation for tribes changed over time? Is it adequate or not in your mind, and why or why not?
When we first began the program, those of us who were working in it recognized the need for funding for our tribal colleagues, that you can't expect this sort of participation for free. When we were working on the first EIS, each of the tribes who were participating, there was a funding agreement with Bureau of Reclamation, and that their staff time, their travel, all those things were compensated. When we started moving into, after the Record of Decision, into the Adaptive Management Program, the woman who was the former reclamation archaeologist, a woman named Signe Lerald, and I came up with what we felt was an adequate dollar figure at the time for one staff person at a GS-11, which would be an equivalent position to a resource specialist, to participate on a full-time basis, and an amount of money to support a tribal river trip and compensation for elders. And we ballparked it, and this would be in 1995, at $95,000. That each of the tribes, that would be sort of their base, so they could hire somebody and then have money for these other things.
And it provided a lump sum, and they could use it any way they wanted.
Right.
But that's the ballpark was how you, okay.
That's how we figured it out.
Yeah.
We said, if it was us, we would have one staff person and then travel and money for honorarium. That's what we would do. So that's how it started out. And those dollars then were taken out of the Department of the Interior's budget as a whole, off the top, and then put into a funding source for the tribes that reclamation administered through annual contracts. Oh. The problem is,
this wasn't from hydropower revenue. This was straight out of the federal budget.
The problem is that there has never been any adjustments over time for cost of living or wages or any of the other reasons why one's budget goes up. There's not ever been a shift, yet everything else in the program got funding, additional funding put to it. And that's never been adjusted. Uh-huh. And as many different times as we've tried to explain, and I've tried to explain how that number came up, and I sit in meetings often and I listen to people talk about what they must have meant when they wrote this or did this, and I'm sitting there saying, I'm the one who actually wrote it, so maybe you should just ask me, because I actually know. And it was never meant to be a static number. It was a starting number, but it's never changed. So from 1995, 96 until now, it's not changed. And the needs have changed. The wages have changed, obviously. Okay. All of those things have changed over the last 25 years, and nothing has changed. So it's a problem. And then there's just the mechanisms of contracting that reclamation has to do. And that's the lag time in coming up with, this is the agreement, this is the work plan, and then actually having the funding transferred can be enormous. So it's unfortunate, and because the tribes themselves don't necessarily have funding for this. I mean, this is something that if you were to go out to Hopi, most people who work at Hopi would have no idea that the Hopi tribe has staff who work on this, because it's not important to them in their daily lives. It's not something they pay attention to, so that it's not built into the tribal budget. So when Hopi doesn't get their allocation, that means that the staff person that they have working on this has to get put on another project where they have funding, and that creates a big gap. When they're going to do an evaluation, a monitoring river trip, if they don't have the trip money to fund the trip or compensation for their elders, it's an unfair ask for them to do this for free, because we are asking as the federal government for their best evaluation of how the resources are doing in the canyon. And it's a continual problem for all of the tribes. And I don't understand why it's so hard to get the funding mechanisms in place. I will say that for the Park Service, our agreements take forever to get through as well. But we have a little more flexibility with our funding, that we can use funding from our base to cover the staff who are working on river-related projects, and when those funds come in, we can just transfer back to the accounts that they're supposed to be in. So we have a little bit more flexibility. Our administrative people hate it, but we track it pretty well. We know what our projects are and how much it's going to cost, and we've got full budget information, but for the tribes, they don't necessarily have that level of flexibility within the tribal budgets to do that.
Most of the other stakeholders have representatives who are working, salaried people working for an agency, for example, and they have their own salaries and travel budgets and stuff like that.
So with the 25 different stakeholders who participate in the Adaptive Management Program and work group, all the federal agencies have their staff. Bureau of Reclamation staff is paid for mainly out of basin fund monies. So they're actually using not appropriate dollars, but power revenues for their staff. Western Area Power, their funds come out of the Basin Fund, so they're tapping into power revenues to fund their programs. I've always found it interesting that many of our colleagues from other entities, whether they be state or municipal, some of the power and water interests, seem to have the ability to send more staff to meetings than those of us who manage these lands have. Because for the most part, we're a one- or two-person show, and you'll be sitting there, and there'll be four people from Western Area Power, for example, or five people, you know, multiple people from each of the states, and we can barely cover it with one person because we just don't have, we have so many other things to do, but these programs are obviously important enough to the participants that they dedicate time and money to them. more than I'm afraid we have the ability to do.
And they have access to hydropower revenue outside the regular federal budgeting process.
Yeah.
And that's a benefit that you would want to hang on to, I suppose.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And more flexibility in how they spend it than you would have in a regular budgeted appropriation.
Yeah, I mean, for Grand Canyon, I mean, one of the things you asked me early on was the roles that I played. Well, I was the archaeologist here and led the, and was responsible for the initial survey. I was part of the initial EIS writing team. Then when the record of decision was issued, and as part of that piece, I actually was working for our Washington office to finish off the first environmental impact statement and write the record of decision. I was detailed to our Washington office, physically located in Salt Lake City, working in Reclamation's office to finish writing the whole adaptive management portion of that first EIS and the record of decision.
Hmm.
So that was one of the things that I was tasked with doing. The two other National Park Service people who had been working on it had left at that point in time, so I was the last gal standing.
Last standing.
And was, you know, the only Park Service person in Salt Lake City at the time, and was working in Reclamation's office to write how adaptive management program was going to be, the alignment of it, what the research program was going to look like, which was a small 6 to 8 person coordinating group. It's not how it's ended up, but that was the initial idea. So that was another role that I filled, which was that of the Park Service's representative. I was there at the signing of the first record of decision with Bruce Babbitt. He thought my name was Mary. I have an autographed copy of that. not Mary, but my colleagues in Reclamation said that they had the power vested in them for some reason to change my name if I needed.
We're interviewing Bruce in a couple of weeks.
Are you? Okay. Yeah. So we did. We actually did the signing at the Papago Park area.
Phoenix?
Yeah. Uh-huh. That's where we did the signing.
Wow.
So, yeah.
I'll ask him about that.
I was there. I'm sure he doesn't remember that he called me Mary or who I am. But yeah, so, you know, so that was another role, which is archaeologist and specialist to represent our Washington office, as sort of to finish that, and then moving into the establishment of the adaptive management program as being the technical work group representative for Grand Canyon. And we had modeled the TWIG, the technical work group, after the technical writing team from the EIS.
Uh-huh.
We had a really good working group of specialists, and we all took off our agency hats so that we can combine as ologists and specialists to do those evaluations and actually write the EIS. And our naive idea in the 90s was that we could continue that camaraderie once the EIS was finished, once the record of decision was finished, and we're moving into this long-term program, we would have the same type of relationship moving forward. It was naive, because all of a sudden, once it was done, it became much more political. And the agency hats were staking out positions, not for the good of the Grand Canyon, as the Grand Canyon Protection Act identified, but now that it's done, how can we make sure that we get what we need out of this? And for me, being a relatively simpleton, I just wanted to see the resources of the canyon protected and improved. And if couldn't do that, mitigate any damage. That was what we were trying to get through.
Mm-hmm. The Bureau of Reclamation and the National Park Service haven't always had the same interests or collaborative relationship over this issue. But you were writing the EIS in the Bureau of Reclamation office, regional office in Salt Lake City. What was the nature of the relationship at that point? Was it better, or was it always, did they always see you as a kind of an outsider and representative of another agency with a different mission and different interests?
So the Reclamation Park Service relationship was definitely strained over at times. And a lot of it had to do with what the mission of Reclamation as they saw it was versus the mission of the Park Service. And, you know, we've always been the tree huggers. We always will be because we are the stewards and we are the forever people. And their role is very different. They've got a dam to operate.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, I think there was some resistance to recognizing they had an environmental mandate. I think individuals like Dave Wagner clearly saw the environmental mandate, and he was sort of a renegade within reclamation. This might maybe why we got along so well. But I think others were very much in the engineering mode of this: we build dams and we don't, and we flood things. We don't protect things. That's a different.
Was Floyd Dominy still in charge when you started?
No, but I think that people who he hired were.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, the mindset was definitely there. Uh-huh. We're engineers. We don't care about this other stuff. That's fluff. We don't do that.
Right.
So I think that that made it hard. The individuals that I work with on the writing team, fabulous, because they, again, they took off their agency hat and said, we have a Grand Canyon Protection Act now. We know what we're supposed to do. NEPA gives us these guidances. We have the Protection Act that says what we're supposed to do. Let's do our best. And from the very beginning, the folks on that writing team, we all clearly saw what we could do in terms of how to manage that dam so that we could improve conditions downstream.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't get everything done that we wanted to. And one of the things that we had started with early on was we all believed we needed to add sediment back into the river.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked about a slurry line and including that in the very first EIS.
Wow.
We were summarily told repeatedly that that was outside of scope and it wasn't going to happen. We also understood that temperature was a controlling factor with the endangered fish, and we had recommended a temperature control device early on. And we were summarily told, not going to happen, not going to include it, outside of scope.
And this is the Bureau of Reclamation summarily telling you that.
Their own people and the rest of us who are on that writing team.
Because so they would be responsible for implementing both of those mitigation measures,
right.
A sediment slurry line from higher in the reservoir,
mm-hmm.
and these temperature control. Actually, one of our mm-hmm. interviewees was telling us about the proposals for the temperature control.
Mm-hmm.
It may have been Carl Walters, if I remember correctly. But
Carl came in much later into this discussion.
Yeah.
It was a guy named Dave Truman, who, if you haven't interviewed him, he actually did the environmental assessment. He's since retired from Reclamation, but he was actually tasked with doing the environmental assessment to look at that subsequent to that first EIS.
What was his first name?
Dave. Truman.
Dave Truman,
yeah.
And he worked for?
He worked for Reclamation. He's since retired.
Uh-huh.
But if you go back to those early documents, that stuff was in there. Everybody who worked on that initial document will tell you that those are the two things that if we could have done, included, would have been sediment, augmentation of some sort, and temperature control.
Uh-huh.
Because those are the two pieces that the dam excluded that was part of that natural system that was interrupted.
So there are programs now for trying to restore some sediment, and the high flow experimental mm-hmm. events are part of that. Is there any progress in temperature control?
So there's two parts of that question. I'm going to talk a little bit about the high flow piece. So one of the things that we included in the first EIS were two different types of high flows. One was a beach habitat building flow and then a habitat maintenance flow, two different things that we included. Because even then, we knew that we needed to manage what little sediment we had since we couldn't get augmentation. We, those of us who wrote that document and those of us who helped write that record of decision, felt that we had set it up pretty well, that based on certain sediment loads, we would be able to trigger habitat building flow, beach building flows and habitat maintenance flows. After the first one in 1996, found out that others felt that we didn't have the environmental compliance to do additional ones. So we got stopped after the first set,
mm-hmm.
which was the record of decision laid out in adaptive management program that was supposed to be the starting point, not the ending point for operations, and we could never get beyond. That was the start. Mm-hmm. Also a change of administrations at that point in time, a little bit of a shift in how the Bureau of Reclamation and the stakeholders viewed the environmental responsibilities and what flexibility we had in the adaptive management program. And that set up another set of tense discussions and meetings and many of the adaptive management meetings after that.
Was that the shift from the Clinton administration to the second Bush administration?
It was.
Okay. Right.
It was.
And can you quickly explain the difference between a maintenance flow and a
building flow. So what we had looked at in the first EIS was these two different types of flows, recognizing that we needed larger flows to be able to deposit sediment higher in the system. So a building flow would have been a larger flow above power plant capacity. A maintenance flow would have been a lower level within power plant capacity to try to keep the sediment there once we got it there. So we had looked at both things, knowing that the system was built on perturbation. Every year there would be different sorts of flooding events with different amounts of sediment in it. Mm-hmm. So how do you go about trying to maintain and then build upon? Because we also knew that we were in a losing situation since we didn't have the sediment coming in. So mm-hmm. we knew then that, that those are the things that we needed.
And you can't have a high flow event that builds beaches unless there's a lot of sediment in that high flow. Otherwise, it's just taking more of the sediment
right.
away, right?
And taking that away is kind of what happened in the 80s after the initial huge flows of 100,000, 93,000. It started stripping. Uh-huh. So you have a combination. So we got to see both things. Uh-huh. So you've got the two different kinds of flows that we built in to that first EIS. We were only able to affect one or two after 96. The 96 one, I think we did a short one after that. But that led us to not being able to because of some legal challenges. And then I'm going to jump a little bit forward for a sec, but we ended up under Secretary Lujan in the Obama administration doing a high flow experiment environmental assessment that set up a program for us to do high flow experiments on a routine basis. Whenever we had enough sediment. And I was part of that environmental assessment process as well and making that part of a routine that then got rolled in to the most recent environmental impact statement, the long-term experimental and management plan, EIS, that we finished in December of 2016. One would think that if you had to write an EIS for Glen Canyon Dam once, you would never have to do it again. But apparently, if you stick around long enough, you get to write it twice. And that would be me and Mike Yates, who got to do it twice.
Good. We'll talk to him about that tomorrow.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, he's going to, I'm sure he'll have a lot of the same things to say about that. It was frustrating. The other question you asked was about temperature.
Right.
So when we started looking at temperature control early on, during the first EIS, we were at a full reservoir level. The water coming out of the reservoir was cold and clear. Over the last 20 years, we've been in a bit of a drought. The reservoir levels have been going down.
Bit of a drought.
Reservoir levels have been going down. And with the lowered lake levels, you've got warmer temperatures coming out of the lake.
Mm-hmm.
So now one of the concerns is maybe the water's too warm. Maybe we need to have it be cooler. The thing about a temperature control device is it would give you the ability to decide within a range of only a couple degrees, but a couple degrees C makes a big difference for native fish. And I'm an archaeologist, even. I figured that part out. It makes a difference. That where you pull the water off the lake makes a difference. And that as that goes downstream, you know, you've got solar warming all the way down. So having the ability to control the temperature would be a benefit for the aquatic life in the system. So at this point, it's almost where we have concerns about some of the warm water non-natives, not so much the cold water non-natives. But the other part of that, as I'm looking at the map on my wall here, is Glen Canyon Dam has protected us from a lot of bad non-native predators that are in the upper Colorado River system. So that because of the dam...
Such as?
The smallmouth bass is a biggie, which I don't understand why they call them smallmouth, because they have enormous mouths. Walleye, pike, and there's a number of nasty predators, but the bass are the worst striped bass. And the striped bass are in the reservoir and up in the upper Colorado, that the Grand Canyon population of humpback chub, for example, is the healthiest in the entire Colorado River system. Up in Westwater, they've pretty much been wiped out because of striped bass. So we have a system that's actually, in a way, protected, and that we're kind of getting some invasives coming in around the edges that we're still trying to keep at bay.
Talking about rainbow and brown trout?
Rainbow and brown trout, green sunfish, walleye, stripers coming up from the lake, from Lake Mead.
From Lake Mead below.
Yeah. So, but we still have a really healthy native population, and our native population is getting stronger. So something that we're doing within this, it may not be us at all, it may just be the fact that the water is warmer these days, is helping our natives do better. Mm-hmm. We've been controlling brown trout in particular, so the source population for those at Bright Angel, and we're seeing a native population explode. The western Grand Canyon sections are dominated by natives now, a lot of bluehead and flannelmouth sucker along with humpback chub. So we're seeing our natives actually increasing.
Great.
So something within what we laid out there is working.
Maybe the temperature change from the reservoir declining over the last 17, 18 years of drought.
I think everyone thinks that temperature was key, and we did back in the 90s when we were working on the first EIS. It was sediment and temperature. It's like, it was pretty obvious, and it still is.
Let me ask you a clarifying question about that shift from when you were writing the EIS to when the adaptive management program came into place. It sounds like you were saying that the technical writing group that worked on writing the EIS morphed pretty quickly into what's now called the technical work group, TWIG. Did that TWIG exist before what's now called the AMWIG, the Adaptive Management Working Group?
Yeah.
What was the time frame for the creation of those groups?
So when the writing team was comprised of a small number of individuals, really, who had this technical background. I was the archaeologist. Steve Carruthers was working for the Hualapai tribe at that point.
He was, okay.
Yeah, it was kind of funny.
He's on our list as a potential interviewee. Do you think we
should? Oh, yeah.
Okay.
He'll be very colorful. He and Wegner together would be a lot of fun.
Oh, get them together in the same interview.
Yeah. Okay. They would be, and I would like to have a beer and
you
lunch.
You want to be there.
Because it will be a lot of fun.
Great.
It would be a lot
That's
of fun.
That's a great suggestion.
Yeah, and I'll come too, because I can egg them on. That would be totally fun. So we had the small writing team that represented Bureau of Reclamation, Park Service, Fish and Wildlife Service, Western Area Power, and the tribes were all part of this writing team. That team went away with the completion of the Record of Decision. When we wrote in the Record of Decision and in the EIS itself, the description of what this team was going to be, this new technical work group and the adaptive management work group, we wrote the descriptions of those. We envisioned that technical work group to emulate the writing team. It turned out that, again, we were naive because each of the stakeholders placed their people as their technical specialist, and unfortunately they weren't necessarily technical in nature. The representatives were much more agency policy driven than technical, and they didn't take off those agency hats at the door.
They became representatives of a particular stakeholder.
Yep.
Rather than, okay.
Yeah, and that was an error, I think, in the way we had described it earlier on. I don't know if it would have mattered if we had described it differently, because once we went into the adaptive management program and the way that was going to be played out, if you didn't win during the EIS, you had your opportunity then during the adaptive management. You could try to influence how the funding was going to get spent, what research was going to get done, all of those things now in the post-EIS arena. Uh-huh. And that pretty much carried on for the last 20 years. And there was a lot of frustration with what things got funded, what things didn't get funded. We were stymied to get a lot of the archaeological work funded. Didn't happen out of that program because there were individuals who didn't believe that Glen Canyon Dam operations were affecting these archaeological properties, no matter how many times we documented it and how many studies we did. Because they were outside the flow zone, they weren't affected. But when you look at the integrity of archaeological properties, historic properties, and the legal structure of how you evaluate them that are articulated in 36 CFR Part 800, you look at direct, indirect, and cumulative. And we know that without sand that is forming the substrate for those deposits, they're going to erode. And the argument from some of the folks in the system, in the program, mainly from Western Area Power and CRETA, those two in particular, said, well, that's about the existence of the dam, not the operation of the dam, so it's not considered. And we all are saying, well, how can you separate out those two? Because if you operated the dam differently to preserve sediment, for example, it is about the operation. And all of the money that's being spent on endangered species and the humpback chub, trout, all of that stuff, well, you have a problem with trout because of the existence of the dam, not the operation of the dam. yet they don't have any problem with funding those programs. Mm. And I'm sure Mike will articulate it because it comes up all the time, and we fight this all the time. It's like, and we gave up fighting because we were losing properties. And we ended up finding a way through some Park Service fee money to fund a project we call Grand Archaeology.
To stabilize the sites?
We did excavations at 10 of the most endangered sites, 9 of the most endangered sites. And it's a huge multi-volume monograph that we came out from doing those excavations. But we also worked with Reclamation for a number of years on stabilization of these properties. So we worked with the Pueblo of Zuni. They had a for their soil conservation program. We had folks from Hopi who were engaged with doing preservation work on the reservation. We started out doing some great ruins. It wasn't really ruins because it was really landscape preservation work on sites down there. And this would have been in probably 95, 96, right when we were finishing the EIS. We started doing the first preservation projects down there. And we did a workshop up at Lee's Ferry. We did a river trip where all the tribes sent folks down so we could start working on how do we go about stabilizing the landscape mm-hmm. to keep these properties. Because ultimately, our goal is to keep everything in place. Mm-hmm. You know, we want the histories of the ancestors to be where they were left, not collected,
not in a museum,
none of that
archived.
Stuff. But let's create the landscape situation where things could be preserved in place. Uh-huh. And our first big project was actually at Palisades Delta, which is a couple miles downstream of the Little Colorado River confluence. And we have a video that we did of that project to show how we did it. The Zuni did these basket weave kind of features within the drainages to try to stop some of the water flow. Mm-hmm. We did rerouting of trails. We put in check dams. We did all sorts of stuff to try to actually keep these sites in place. And that's something we had all bought into. But we ran into problems with reclamation at that point in time and some of the other adaptive management program members who didn't feel that we should be spending any money on cultural resources and archaeology. And I'm afraid that that's still a bit of a problem. Mm-hmm. And I think when you look at why the tribe's funding has stayed static, mm-hmm. why there hasn't been money put towards preservation of these sites, it all gets back in some ways it's unfortunate, but I think there's a view amongst some of these stakeholders that history and culture don't matter, or it's not their responsibility, one or the other. Mm-hmm. Or, sorry, but it's not the dam. And it's like, you know, really? And we keep going back, it's the existence versus the operation. It's like, really?
Is that distinction still relevant today?
It seems to be, and it seems to keep coming up, even though we've settled it more than once. Mm-hmm. We started doing work with USGS on the geomorphology issues related to the canyon back in the early 90s as well. Some of the early work that Rich Herford did with us, looking at how it is that these sites are eroding out. I mean, we started doing that with Herford, with Lukita, with Joel Pedersen after that. I mean, take your pick. Joel Sankey now. It's like over and over again, we have documented the reasons why Amy East's work looking at the different types of sites and the geomorphic situation where they get eroded. I mean, there's classes of sites. We've gone through multiple times of this, and it's like we would have spent a whole lot less money if we just would have been able to go treat the sites. Then you continuing to say that it's not affecting. It's like, yeah, it is. Well, prove it. And it's like, okay, so we'll have another study funded. And you'll listen to some of our tribal colleagues, in particular our friends at Zuni, and Kurt Dungowski in particular, who was fed up with looking at funding going to geology, essentially, which is the sediment studies, when it should be going to archaeology. Because pretty much it's called a cultural resource support monies, but it's not. It's going to more sediment work, more geomorphology. It's giving us nothing in terms of preserving the archaeological sites or the associative values that the tribes ascribe to these places. I mean, all of these places are parts and parcel of tribal histories. Mm-hmm. And unless you're going to actually take the time to work with the tribes on these places, you'll never get those associative values. What you get is a fairly routine version of archaeology. And, you know, I'm a culprit of that myself. That's how I came into this program, and at some point in time, I realized there was a whole lot more to it, which is when we started bringing the tribes in. Mm-hmm. But it's hard to get the funding mechanism to be able to provide adequate support to be able to look at those associative values. And we had talked about taking some areas that were relatively easy to access upstream of Lee's Ferry, where you've got the minus 9 mile petroglyph panel, which is pretty well known. It's archaic petroglyphs that are in the cliff face there. Well, they're right at ground level, and you know that people are not laying down to peck these things in, that the living surface had to be down below them. Hmm. It's like, let's take an area like that and let's work with the tribes who have histories here and combine archaeology with traditional values, with ethnography, with associative values, and actually design and develop and implement a study of one place to see how it works. Hmm. I haven't been able to get that done yet. That's one of the things I still wish I could get done.
So you have a plan for it. You have partners for it. You have a place where you can do it. You're waiting for
funding
from the program?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. And I think everyone has, there's an acknowledgement amongst the cultural practitioners, whether it be the federal side or the tribal side, that that's what we need to be looking at. Mm-hmm. But it's having the investment to make it happen. Mm-hmm. And with all of us, I mean, the staff that Grand Canyon has working on this gets no funding out of the program, and everybody has another job to do. Yeah. I mean, my plate is full with multiple other things, and this is just one of the many things that I'm tasked with doing. So in addition to being the TWIG representative, I'm also the alternate for the National Park Service's superintendent at Grand Canyon for the AMWIG role. So I have both of those pieces within this program. Mm-hmm. And I've been the alternate AMWIG member for multiple Grand Canyon superintendents. When the Obama administration came in, the federal family was gotten together by Ann Castle, who was the mm-hmm. former assistant secretary, who said, you know what? We are all part of this. We all need to not be infighting. Mm-hmm. We, the agencies, have to give our best recommendations to the secretary who's responsible for this. So we, the federal family, need to come together, and we're not going to be voting with our stakeholders. It's a pretty odd thing for us to vote with our stakeholders on a recommendation to us. So we should not be doing that. Uh-huh. And again, in hindsight, because I was one of the ones who helped create the original adaptive management framework and all the 25 stakeholders, when you look at it that way, it makes no sense for us to vote on a recommendation to us, because we're all representing the Secretary of the Interior in this. So when Ann pulled us out of being voting members of the AMWIG, it changed another dynamic. And some of the tribes were really concerned that that would mean that we would be less engaged because we didn't have a vote. I mean, prior to that, we'd have some pretty difficult meetings where the basin states and the power and water interests would vote one way. The Park Service and the Fish and Wildlife Service, who have responsibilities for historic properties and endangered species, would vote another way. The tribes would abstain, and we'd get outvoted on our own policies and our mandates. And it's like, this is crazy. We can't do this. And it would happen all the time. And it was made it really hard.
Well, making you non-voting members, wouldn't that weaken your voice even more?
Except that the secretary is going to make that decision, and it's going to get recommendations from the agencies that report to the secretary. Uh-huh. So by having all of the DOI agencies talk about these things beforehand and have consistency in understanding leaders' intent within the program and agents' responsibilities, we actually then can come together and say, this is our collective recommendation. And you see that play out in the last years of the Obama administration and Ann Castle's tenure, the high-flow experiment EA that we got done, and then the LTEMP, where the Park Service and Reclamation were joint leads, which is the first time that had ever happened. And that was a big deal. Because usually we get the folding chair at the end of the table. This time we actually had a real chair at the table. Yeah.
So did those changes survive beyond Ann Castle's tenure?
So right now the makeup of the Adaptive Management Work Group does not have the federal agencies, the DOI agencies, as voting members.
DOI, Department of Interior.
Yes.
Which includes Bureau of Reclamation, Park Service, Fish and Wildlife Service, any others?
Bureau of Indian Affairs. Uh-huh. However,
But the tribes represent themselves. They're not represented by BIA, but the BIA has a representative.
They have a fiduciary responsibility to participate. Because there are tribes, like the Havasupai, for example, who are part of the canyon but who don't participate. So in that way, they have another role for tribes that have an interest but aren't here.
Okay.
The outlier in all this is WAPA.
Western Area Power
Administration.
Administration.
Who every so often they want to be called Western, but now they want to be called WAPA again. Not quite sure why. One sounds friendlier than the other. Western sounded friendly, but now they've gone back to WAPA. Could be a change of administration that made that decision for them. They want to be part of the federal family, but they want to vote. So they're still a voting member of the AMWIG because they're not part of Interior. And so they had this odd role where they want to be part of the inside discussion with the secretary, but then they want to be in the outside to be able to do whatever maneuvering they would like to do outside the Interior.
Kind of
and they have been playing that a lot, and their interests are purely economic.
Yeah. Just occurred to me, U.S. Geological Survey is another Interior agency.
Right.
They don't vote anymore either.
No, right. And they never did, even in the early things, because they're the science provider. They're not a manager
they're
of the resource.
Okay.
Because that's the thing. I mean, these are about who's managing this resource. Reclamation manages the water releases. Park Service obviously manages the land-based. Fish and Wildlife Service has responsibilities for endangered species work. BIA has a trust responsibility to the tribes in their best interest. So, you know, within that, but GS doesn't manage anything other than they're the science provider.
Uh-huh. Okay. Interesting.
Yeah.
So you brought us right up to the point where we had a group of people writing an EIS, and then there's a transition, and suddenly we have an adaptive management program with an incipient AMWIG, Adaptive Management Working Group, and an incipient TWIG. Mm-hmm. Which came first? How did those evolve? And how did you get the tribes in there right from the start?
So with when we finished the Record of Decision, in it there was an environmental commitment for adaptive management.
This is 96.
In 96. It was March, I think March of 96 is when Babbitt signed it. And the Grand Canyon Protection Act provided the structure for that with the stakeholders and everything, consultation with the tribes. And I'm pretty sure the tribes were named at the time because they were the same tribes that were participating in as cooperating agencies in the EIS.
Okay.
So there was a transition of close to 2 years from when it was finished to when the formal adaptive management program started. And the structure of that did come out of the Protection Act, but it was also articulated more better defined, I guess, in the Record of Decision as to how this would move forward. There's a lot of debate as to where the science provider would be.
Mm-hmm.
There was some misgiving about it resting with Bureau of Reclamation as a science provider because of some perceived conflicts at that point in time. Babbitt had created the National Biological Survey at that point, the NBS. So there was a thought that maybe that would be the institutional home. That didn't last very long.
Right.
So ultimately it ended up being within the USGS, which
was seen to be a more neutral agency.
And they are indeed identified as the science provider for the Department of the Interior. I mean, their reputation for that. But again, they were generally looking at geologic resources. So the fact that this program included cultural, biological, was a bit of a stretch, so they really had to restructure a lot of what they were doing and bring in some additional expertise. You had a senior scientist, Duncan Patton was the senior scientist from ASU when we were working on the first EIS. National Academy of Sciences did a lot of reviews of all of that work, of the GCES work and how we move forward. There was there was a big interest in how this large adaptive management program would be played out because, again, there hadn't been one quite like this.
Mm-hmm.
There were some examples from the Pacific Northwest and the Columbia that were used.
Mm-hmm.
But this was the seven basin states have a different role to play. And the water that we're talking about was part of the 1922 compact and there was a lot of other legal challenges that had to be addressed. And then you've got a little bit of this drought thing going on. And then you've got, in 2007, the interim guidelines that were issued by Reclamation for how they're going to manage the reservoirs between Powell and Meade. Mm. And within that, they didn't really integrate in well the provisions of the Grand Canyon Protection Act, the 1996 Record of Decision, or any of the information since then. So it's almost like they forgot that they had this whole thing in between the two reservoirs.
Right, and a park.
And a park, a little bit. So, I mean, and so that also had kind of added into some of the complexities, because you've got the upper basin not wanting to let any water go until they have to. You got the lower basin with more people saying we need the water sooner. Mm-hmm. You've got a brokered deal that Babbitt was involved in terms of how to work the guidelines between the upper and lower basins in terms of criteria for... You can't just hold it up in the north. You got to let it go to the south. I mean, you, upper basin states, lower basin states, you got to figure it out. But there were certainly disagreements amongst the seven states, the four upper and three lower, as to how they were going to balance this stuff. So right. You've got then the elevational tiers for how much water gets released based on that. And that's a whole
lot of complicated moving parts.
A lot of other moving. And then you've got the minute, whatever it was called, for the pulse flows that went to Mexico that happened during the Obama administration, because Mexico has theoretically a water allocation out of this that they rarely see.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you've got all of these moving parts. So all of this is a complicated system. And then within this, you have the needs for certain environmental flows to do good within the canyon that... If you do them the way many of us were hoping we could do them, there's a perception that it would cost too much money to the power interests, mm-hmm. that you would be wasting water, wasting power. When you bypass the generators, it's lost revenue, potentially.
At least at that one dam.
You still have that
water for the next dam, but you lost it at Glen Canyon.
Right, and they're administered differently. Mm-hmm. So, you know, for me, I'd always looked at it as potential profit not realized, because you don't know if you had a buyer for that electricity. Mm-hmm. But that is just me saying, well, you might not have. And if you're running at full power plant capacity, you've got extra electricity to sell. And talking to the power people, they say, well, yes, but you don't know if you have a buyer, so you might just have to flood the market and then the price goes down. It's like, and that's why I'm not an economist. It's like, okay, I sort of get it. But ultimately, for us, it's about how do we regulate flows given the sideboards we have so that we can actually improve conditions in the canyon, mm-hmm. for all of the resources. So it keeps getting back to how can we best do that, knowing that we're in the forever business, we're stewards of this place, and we need to pass it on in at least as good, if not better, condition than we found it.
How would you sort of, you know, historians like periodizing history. We like breaking the past into chunks in which you can talk about there being sort of a consistent cultural inclination. I mean, there's the Depression, the Progressive Era, World War II. How would you periodize the stretch from the time and when the Record of Decision was completed in 1996 to the present, where there eras in which certain things prevailed, certain scientific research was done, certain policies were more influential than others, certain stakeholders were more at the table. How would you break that up?
Fish and sand.
Fish and sand.
That's it.
Over the entire period?
Yep.
So those are the issues that got the most amount of attention from 96 to the present.
Yep.
Yeah.
And still do.
We have seen that in all of our interviews and the documentation.
Yep, fish and sand. But and what's interesting is, so the Fisheries or Endangered Species Act, sand, it's the substrate for everything, but there's actually no law that says that you have to do this. Mm-hmm. Really, it's about Section 106, National Historic Preservation Act, and protecting those historic properties, mm-hmm. so that there is a clear connection in most of our minds, except for those who say it's not the existence versus operation of the damn thing. But most of us understand that connection. But all of the funding has gone to fish and sand.
So some of the among the stakeholders are recreation interests, and it seems to me that Another group that's very concerned about sand are the river runners,
right.
Because that's where people camp. That's right. The only place you can pull off
right.
For the night. And so would you say that the emphasis on fish and sand reflects the dominance of certain stakeholders, or does it reflect legislation and law, like the Endangered Species Act and the Grand Canyon Trail?
I think ESA...
Why is that?
ESA is huge. Endangered Species, because it gets litigated in particular. Mm-hmm. So most of the stakeholders, regardless of where you're coming from, are going to be really concerned about Endangered Species Act compliance.
Okay.
So the focus on humpback chub, the states are going to support that. The power interests are going to support that. I mean, that's an important piece of this. The recreational users, and it's, you know, you think about it, the Grand Canyon Protection Act talks specifically about natural and cultural and recreational uses.
Right.
You know, the public perception of the diminished resources in the canyon came from those recreational users. They are the ones who saw it every day. They're the ones who saw the daily tides and watched the beaches go away.
They wrote the letters
to Congress. There were trips guides would bring postcards with them and have their clients fill them out while they're there, and they'd send them out at Phantom. You know, so they were actively engaged. Once we started a program of interim flows when we were working on the first EIS.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of was our best guess at the time for how to do no more harm.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a fairly restricted flow pattern at that point in time, which carried through into the final recommendations in the EIS. And what we did in LTUB isn't all that much different, to be honest. I mean, we got it pretty right.
Mm-hmm.
It's really sediment and temperature, though, no matter what. So within that, we still have recreational boating. When we first started doing the work back in the early 80s and into the 90s, we had really low flows. So there would be days where the river would be down to 1,500 CFS and nights where it would go up to 28, 30, 32,000. So huge variations.
And that's because of management of the hydropower dam.
Okay. So that you'd have recreational groups that would get stuck because there's not enough water,
mm-hmm.
and all of a sudden get flooded out. So the concerns, there was a lot of safety concerns. You
mm-hmm.
had water rising really fast. You had fishermen up in the Lees Ferry area who would have their waders on and all of a sudden not realize that they were, maybe because they were numb from the waist down, I don't know, because the water is so cold, that their waders are filling up. And there were some serious incidents with fishermen back in those days, not realizing how quickly the water levels would change. River rafts would get stuck on big rocks. They'd have to wait for the water to come up to float off. So the lower the water, the more rocks, the more incidents where people would get knocked about a lot. Mm-hmm. Higher water is actually, a lot of the rapids wash out. At a certain water flow, there's a phenomenon called a hydraulic jump that would happen, and it happened at Crystal where there was like a 40-foot hole that developed at about 60,000 CFS that was flipping every boat that went through, and we'd have to go rescue people. It was, you know, there was a bit of a mess. So the control of water flows within a fairly narrow set of parameters has actually made boating safer. In that way, because they're
intentionally or by accident?
Well, I think both. I mean, mm-hmm. we talked a lot about minimum flows so that we could try to keep the rocks underwater and a certain maximum flow so that we still had that recreational experience and we maintained the sediment on the beaches, that we didn't wash them away. So we definitely work within those parameters to try to find that sweet spot for recreation as well. But that's a resource that people don't understand. And we talk about how much economic value recreation brings to the region, because it's one of the few things that the power interests, it's all about how much money is being made off this electric resource.
Right.
Well, there's more to it than that. I mean, we pioneered in a lot of ways the non-use value studies that were in the first EIS. That there is a value, an existence value of knowing that the Grand Canyon exists and is maintaining its integrity, that the resources are being taken care of. And there were a lot of folks who weren't particularly happy with the fact that we were able to insert within this program this non-use value. Yeah, the existence value. I mean, and some people are still, we have now WAPA pushing the existence value for hydropower, the non-use value of hydropower. And they've got a PhD economist out of Oklahoma who, by golly, is doing that work for them to show that there's this incredible existence value for hydropower that's equal to, you know, the existence value of the Grand Canyon. And it's like, it's actually a use. It's not a non-use. It's a real use. You turn on your lights. I have lights on. I understand that lights are good. Electricity is good, but it doesn't mean that there aren't other ways to get it.
Do you think there are other issues that ought to be addressed besides sand and fish that because maybe there's not a legal angle like the Endangered Species Act to sort of force that issue to the table, it constantly gets neglected?
I do. I mean, I think that, you know, I keep going back to historic properties and tribal values. I mean, that's one that it eludes most everybody. And I mean, you see it in the meetings where when one of our tribal colleagues is giving a presentation, people go out of the room and they go to the bathroom or they'll be reading a newspaper or they'll be surfing the web, and you see that all the time. So you know that they're not vested in it at all. The vegetation components along the river are things that we've been trying to move forward. The tribes have concerns about it as well. We've got encroachment issues that are directly related to dam operations that we are still arguing with some of the stakeholders who believe that the funds are theirs, not to be used for the program. That when you have beaches that are overrun with tamarisk or arrowweed or anything else, that it's actually a function of how the dam works as well. Because without those, that yearly flooding, that stuff doesn't get washed out. You don't have new sediment deposited, and you basically have this whole crop of arrowweed that's just taken over your beach, and there's no place to camp anymore because it's all arrowweed. Or the beach is gone because it's gotten washed out and it's all rock. So if we can, one of the things that we included in the Record of Decision for LTEMP was vegetation management, because we made a direct link and we wrote it into the environmental commitments in the ROD, which made some people unhappy because they don't want to fund vegetation work. And some of the things I'm talking about, these are relatively small mitigation measures that don't cost a lot of money if you just were able to maintain them. So that you go in and you actually do restoration work at a camp where you remove some of the non-natives, you actually manipulate the area so that it catches more sand when we do have a high flow, and you maintain it that way. And for some of the areas that we've identified, it, you can actually do it in a reasonably contained area. It's, you know, it's 280 mile from the dam down to the lake. You're not going to work on all of them, but you can certainly pick out key locations that have cultural significance, where certain plants that are important, or collection areas, things like that. So, or archaeological sites where you need to open up the sand areas so that, and Kurt Dongowski hates this, but sand blows at the bottom of the Grand Canyon, and if the more sand you have, the more it blows. And as much as those of us who have camped down there aren't always all that happy waking up as part of a sand dune,
right,
that sand blows back up to the old river terraces and reburies those archaeological sites.
Which preserves them.
Which, right, preserves them. So that, you know, we've tried to target certain areas where the prevailing winds are right, where we have good sand deposits. If we keep those as open sandbars, that wind will blow and it will pick up that sand and it will deposit it, because that's where it came from to begin with. We watch the cycle. You see it. Washes back down and then it gets blown back up. And then the only mechanism for depositing sediment down there is the river. And it all comes down, you know, whenever we can capture it. The Paria is our trigger point because the dam keeps everything else upstream.
The Paria River.
The Paria River coming in out of southern Utah. So when we're looking at sand balances, it's the Paria that gives us the biggest bang for our buck. and the prairie is mainly sand, and the Little Colorado is mainly silt and clay. Hmm. So when it's really mucky and slippery and stuff like that, down below the Little Colorado, that's all the gin leaf formations coming in. Mm-hmm. So you want the Paria, which is more of a sand-based. So you're looking at that complement. And if we
Does the Escalante River contribute any sediment?
It's up above Lake Powell.
Oh, it's all captured behind the dam. Okay.
Yeah. So you've only got a limited amount.
Yeah.
Over 90% is kept up above the dam in Lake Powell. So you've only got these two sources
That's
as they
it.
Come downstream. So, and the first 60 miles is all Paria. Once you get below the Little Colorado, you've got a lot more to work with. But you've got 60 miles above is where the critical reaches are.
Mm.
And that's where you're trying to capture as much as possible. So our triggering criteria for high flows is based on what comes in the Paria, because mm-hmm. if not, you'll strip out that first 60 miles with mm-hmm. any kind of flow. So it really, there's some really smart people that we work with on this stuff. We figured this stuff out.
Mm-hmm.
And it's great. There were some, I mean, and this is where, you know, you look at the range of individuals who I've had the opportunity to work with, some who are very much in the environment is just a nuisance. We're about water engineering and operating a dam. And then you move into a kinder and gentler period of reclamation staff, and Katrina Grants, who I'm sure is on the list, who's mm-hmm. the current program lead, and a gal named Kendra Russell, who worked for Reclamation. She now works for GS. But Kendra was critical to developing the criteria for the high flow experiments. I mean, she's brilliant. And she was great to work with on the LTEMP. I mean, we had a small team of folks. It was me, Rob Billerbeck, Katrina, and Kendra. Who kind of made the core group to get this LTEMP stuff done with our contractor at Argonne.
Was Kendra Russell also working for Reclamation?
She was. She's now with USGS, so she's totally findable. She's back east, but she's fabulous. But it's like you go from this very narrow-minded engineering perspective and to these newer, younger, more broadly focused engineers, Kendra and Katrina both, saying, maybe there is a way that we can actually mm-hmm. accomplish the goals that we have in terms of managing the dam and the flows and the environmental concerns that we have that we also have to take responsibility for.
Mm-hmm.
So you had a shift in personnel as well that mm-hmm. actually allowed for a more enlightened approach.
That's a really interesting point. Let me ask you if you think that more enlightened approach or changes in the approach, maybe it's not always more enlightened, but when you see a change in attitude and approach by members of the Adaptive Management Working Group, and particularly Bureau of Reclamation, which kind of holds the purse strings, mm-hmm. Do you think it's, you just kind of implied or suggested that it was a new generation? And as a historian, you see sort of generations and eras. Like there was the Depression era and the war era and the baby boom era. So some of that is in place. But you also mentioned that some of the key changes came with changes in political administrations. Which do you think was more influential in this more recent change, and how do you see the significance of those two different kinds of changes in the long mm-hmm. term of this program?
You know, it's interesting because we look in the Park Service at we're sitting in a Mission 66 building. It's a huge period of time, 1956 to 1966, mm-hmm. Park Service recognizing the post-World War II baby boom, blah, blah, blah.
Recreation.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
It's huge.
Yeah.
So that, you know, I look at our own developmental history, mm-hmm. and it mirrors what's going on in society.
Yeah.
And I think what you're looking at in some of this is it's a coincidence of timing,
uh-huh.
that the shifts in personnel with Reclamation, who were kind of part of the old guard Floyd Dominey world, mm-hmm. were near retirement.
Mm-hmm.
And it just happened to coincide with an Obama administration coming on board.
Mm-hmm.
There was a couple of folks who were hold-ons. There was one woman who worked for Reclamation who I swear started during the Eisenhower administration. and she was still, no matter what, still touting the same line. But I think she realized that times had changed and that some of the attitudes had changed and it was time to retire. So you had a lot of retirements that kind of were happening at the same time. And, you know, part of it is it's just as we all look at the baby boomers starting to get to retirement age. I mean, it was the early part of the baby boomers were retiring. You've got these younger, more open-minded, more creative, coming in with this generation, and it, some of it, I think, is happenstance. I think that we're fortunate in some ways that you had sort of a changing of the administrations and the guard at the same time, and we're also very fortunate that we were able to get the LTEMP signed under Sally Jewell. So the first EIS was signed under Bruce Babbitt, the second one under Sally Jewell.
Both Democratic administrations.
Both with a very strong environmental record.
Have there been any significant shifts in the last year under the new Trump administration? Year and a half now.
I mean, we're all trying to understand that shift. The recent directive to WAPA to transfer all the funding out of the basin fund that was used for environmental programs to Treasury is something that all of the stakeholders are up in arms about. So that's a 25 years of having all of these funds providing support for these programs, and all of a sudden they've decided they're not going to, yet the laws are very clear that that's how those monies are supposed to be used, but it doesn't seem like anybody cares. They're just not going to do it. It's like, well, how can you not do it? It says that you're going to do it. This is the law that says you're going to do it.
In the 1992 Grand Canyon Protection Act,
and
it set up the basin fund.
And subsequent acts that clarified how the funding was supposed to be used.
And so the Trump administration is just kind of sequestering it and saying, we're going to put it back into Treasury, and if you want any money for any of these programs, you have to ask for it in the regular budget process. Is that what's going on?
I don't think that there's been a suggestion that you have to ask for it.
They're just saying, we're taking the money away, too bad.
Yes.
Wow.
That seems to be what we all have understood. And Reclamation is trying their best to get the money back because these are their environmental programs too.
Right.
And the nice thing is that the folks in Reclamation are the same ones who were so committed to making sure that this happened and got that 2016 ROD signed. Mm. It's the same people that we're still working with. And we're all just kind of shaking and saying, well, we don't know what to do next. We have briefed up the chain. Reclamation, USGS, Fish and Wildlife Service, Park Service, all together as the DOI agencies. Indian Affairs didn't have a whole lot to say about it because they're not engaged in that way. Mm-hmm. But the four of us all collectively wrote the same briefing papers, the same perspectives, have sent it up through our chains in Washington, and there's just nobody there. At the last AMWIC meeting, Andrea Travenek was there, and she heard it loud and clear from all of the stakeholders and the agencies.
And she's your representative from the Secretary of Interior's office.
So the way the Adaptive Management Program is set up, it's the Secretary's program. The Secretary has a designee. Mm-hmm. The designee for the program currently is a fellow named Tim Petty. And the alternate designee is Andrea Travenek. The previous meeting, she was representing Water and Science. This meeting, she now has the hat of acting for Fish, Wildlife, and Parks. So you've got both sides of Interior. Mm-hmm. In a way, she's then representing both Water and Science and Fish, Wildlife, and Parks. It's convenient,
Could
I guess.
Could be a good thing. Yeah.
You don't have to brief each other that way. You know it all. But she gets it. I think Mr. Petty got it. Mm-hmm. You know, the seven basin states signing the same letter to the senators, to Congress, to OMB, you know, very concerned about what's going on, and none of them are getting a response. Mm. So it's a very different time, and none of us have ever seen
this. Do you think this is generic, or do you think, I mean, is this the sequestering of funds happening to all the federal advisory committee thing, all the adaptive management programs, or is this sort of being targeted at this program because there's a lot of money associated with it.
This program has a lot of money associated with it, and I'm not sure of other FACA programs with this sort of legal basis for the revenues and for distributing them for environmental programs. I'm not familiar with the other programs, but this one, I think, the number of questions that we get about how this one is structured, I think is fairly unique. We also have the Grand Canyon Protection Act, which there's no other program that has a law like this that directs these sorts of environmental programs. And then you've got the Upper Basin San Juan River and Upper Basin RIP programs that are funded out of this as well. So the Recovery Implementation Program, so it's Endangered Species Act. So the $23 million that's reported that's being taken away from this program, $10 million of it goes to the Glen Canyon Dam Program. The other $13 million is for the other programs that are operated through the Basin Fund and the Upper Colorado River. So, you know, it's...
And you haven't got any explicit rationale for why...
No, not explicit. No
rationale.
No, just OMB has directed WAPA to transfer these monies to the Treasury. No, nothing. Nothing.
And this is the first time in the long history of this program. We're going on 30 years.
Yes, we are.
This is the first time that a complete removal of funding has been threatened.
Yes.
Or just first time
ever.
Ever.
Ever. That there hasn't been funding for these programs. I mean, really, think about it. Since the first GCES studies were in 82.
In the 80s, so we're talking 40 years.
40 years where there's been funding for these programs. And this is one of the few times, I think, all of the stakeholders are on the same page. They're not arguing about operations versus existence. They're all saying, wait a minute, those are monies that we support for this program. How can you be doing this? And as I was talking to one of the state representatives at the Amway, he goes, we can't even get a meeting with OMB. They won't take it. So they don't know who to... They're stuck, which is, you know, usually we just figure it's us who can't get a meeting with anybody, but it's they can't. The environmental groups can't, so the states can't, the water groups can't, power groups can't. I mean, nobody. So they're everybody's in the same situation. And after the last meeting, there was a commitment from the DOI officials, from Andrea and from Tim, to go back to Washington and try to figure it out. But we've heard nothing back from them as to what they figured out. Reclamation has said, and we have said, the department has said, that we're going to do everything we can to make sure that these programs continue. But we don't know really what that will mean. The Park Service doesn't get any of that funding directly. We get it through Reclamation. Reclamation is doing what they can because they understand the importance of these programs, and they will continue to advocate, and they'll try to figure out how they can manipulate the funding that they get to maintain these programs. But $10 million is a lot of money to try to come up with to keep these programs going. And then you've got the other $13 million for the other programs in the Upper Basin. It's a lot of money for them to try to figure out. So it's anybody's guess as to what will happen, but I don't think in all of the years since we've structured this program from the Grand Canyon Protection Act forward, it has always been presumed that the funding out of the Basin Fund would be there, because that's how the laws were written, is to make sure that there is funds to continue this. And all of a sudden having something come out of the blue saying, oh, we've decided we're just going to stop. It's like, well, but we have a law that says that we shall do this. Not that we may, but we shall do this. And they're saying, well, we don't really care. We're just going to not.
Sounds like they're opening themselves to litigation, but of course that could take years. And in the meantime, programs can be unfunded. You know, as a historian of federal agencies and federal budgets, a lot of my work on the history of national forest management looked at that. It is remarkable that this is a program that's had a pretty stable source of funding over a very long period of time. All federal agencies and federal programs, for the most part, have to go through these annual budgeting processes and huge swings in what's being funded and what's not being funded, with each shift in who controls Congress and who's in the administration. But this program is pretty unusual in having a steady source of federal funding. And so, you know, that is seismic in the history of the program, that for the first time that's being threatened.
And it is, and there's, you know, some attempts at fixing it. Senator Hatch out of Utah introduced some legislation. The states would like to make that legislation a little stronger, but it's still, none of us know where it sits. We've seen that it's been introduced. the states have suggested some slight changes to make it stronger.
Mm-hmm. That would direct
the agencies to, that would direct Western Area Power to transfer the money to reclamation as they always have, rather than having it go to Treasury.
Right.
It would be very specific for implementation of the Grand Cayman
Protection Act. Hydropower revenues, certain amount will be earmarked for that, which is where the money's been coming
and
from.
And it was already earmarked that
right.
way. I mean, it has been for all of these years.
But now there's another piece of legislation to try to clarify it one
more time. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And so the states have been very active at trying to get this taken care of. And, you know, as of 2 weeks ago, they still hadn't gotten anywhere.
Uh-huh.
You know.
Well, this is probably a good time for me to ask you whether you think the program should be continued and what its overall value is. I mean, are we done and we can wrap up and go home now, or is there lots more to do? Is it worthwhile maintaining the funding source and fighting for these programs?
So, you know, when you talk about environmental programs or endangered species, there's a lot of the so what. So what if we lose a species? Does it really matter? Is it going to bother you if this snail doesn't exist anymore? But it's part of looking beyond oneself, mm-hmm. and looking at the totality of our environment and what we're trying to pass on. So when you ask the question, is are we done yet? We know that the Grand Canyon is eroding. It will continue to erode, right? Is what we do now going to make a difference? And I guess it's a question of perspective and timing. Mm-hmm. Within our lifetimes, we're responsible for this place. And these programs help us with how we manage and maintain the integrity of place and the histories and connections that we are responsible for the American public, for our tribal, the ancestors and the modern tribal members. We are a World Heritage Site as well, so we have a responsibility for maintaining the property of the Grand Canyon for not just us, but it's a worldwide resource. So, you know, does it matter if we lose this beach? Well, some people would say no. I would say yeah, because it's part of the connection of people in place for a total landscape, not just an individual part of it. And for most of us, we look at this landscape as a whole, and each component of it contributes to understanding and preserving that whole. So does it matter if you lose an endangered species? Well, we as a people thought it was when we passed the Endangered Species Act. Mm-hmm. We as a people have looked at the legacy of our conservation and environment in a way that we intended through our laws to be able to pass them on to the future. So I think that in a society, we've decided that that's a mark of who we are, is how we treat things for the future.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we have decided, for the most part, at least we within our legal structure had decided that when we passed the Grand Canyon Protection Act, when we passed the Endangered Species Act, when we passed the National Historic Preservation Act, we passed these laws for a reason. And I don't see that reason has changed. We still have to care about the legacy of our conservation and what we're passing on. So I think it does matter.
Do you ever imagine what it would be like as an administrator here at Grand Canyon National Park? You ever imagine what it would be like along the river corridor if Grand Canyon Protection Act had never been passed, if the adaptive management program had never been put in place? What do you think would be different?
So, I mean, that's an interesting question. And mm-hmm. actually, I think about two things. I think about what it would have been prior to the dam.
Mm-hmm.
And what that environment would have looked like. Because
mm-hmm.
I kind of wish I had a time machine to go back.
Yeah.
Back 50 years, back 100 years, back 1,000 years, but also then what it would have been had we not been able to put in place some of these environmental protections. So I think about it both ways. In my first scenario, which is what it would have been like before the dam, as an archaeologist, I would have been fat and happy because I wouldn't have seen any of these archaeological sites because they all would have been buried. It would have been great. And it wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't
you
have
wouldn't
had
be
to.
Worrying about
right, because
erosion.
I was the panic attack graduate student saying, oh my God, there's a city that just got eroded. What am I going to do? So, you know, in a way, it's kind of like, I would have been happy. I wouldn't have known any of these things existed. It would have been simpler, for sure. But the second part of that question is, had we not been able to pass the Protection Act, what would the canyon have looked like? And I think that it would have been the opposite. I would have been running around all the time with the sky is falling because at every turn there would have been something else that would have been eroding. Hmm. Another beach that was gone. As the beaches go, our recreational users would have had to go higher and higher up on the landscape, at which would have exposed more and more sites. So it would have been like the Mad Max scenario for me, where it would have been a horrible existence as I'm watching the precious resources and histories that we're responsible for being overtaken. And then we would have had to address a different kind of visitor use, which would have been another set of conflicts because mm-hmm. we have a real pressure on allowing people down in the canyon, and we would have had to have that discussion and probably a pretty public disagreement about how many people could go down. And it would have, from the tribal perspective, we shouldn't let people down there at all anyway because it's a sacred site. In a society like ours, we are going to, and we have been letting people down there. Grand Canyon's 100th birthday is next year, so we've been, you know, certainly responsible for the last 100. So when I think about what it would have been, huge areas would have not had any sand at all. It would have been just rock. We would have had people trying to find places to camp everywhere. We would not have the integrity of the resource that we have today. So in my mind's eye, that would have been a pretty grim view. Mm-hmm. I like the fat and happy part before where I didn't know that all the stuff was there. Yeah.
So adaptive management is an approach to decision making and resource management that acknowledges uncertainty and embraces experimentation and monitoring, acknowledges that we can't predict nature or control nature, and we should be flexible and agile. And you're mentioning earlier about how different it was after the 1983 floods, the El Nino floods, and last time the reservoir was full was right around 2000, and we've had 18 years of drought since then. And you know, the lake behind Glen Canyon Dam is, what, 37% full, and many hydrologists say we will probably never see it full again in our lifetimes. That seems like a situation ripe and perfect for adaptive management. What do you, when you're looking forward at the next 10 or 20 years, with climate change challenges, changing cultural inclinations, a rising population, economic changes, what do you think we're going to be adapting to, and what do we need to pay attention to and think about in the next 10, 20 years?
You know, when you think about that, the shifts in climate patterns are huge.
Yeah.
When you look at the reservoir conditions, both Meade and Powell, and our population growth, it's huge. Our lack of water in the plateau is huge. The lack of a reliable water source for the 6 million visitors we get a year at Grand Canyon is huge. And there needs to be a reality check amongst the seven basin states in particular, that the volumes of water that they are planning for don't exist. And at some point, there has got to be that recognition that the 1922 compact that identified 8.23 million acre feet a year that goes between upper and lower, that's not a reality. I mean, I heard a report, I think it was this morning, that reclamation is looking at by the 20-something or another, that they're going to have shortage again already. Mm-hmm. They're, you know, you're going to be looking at dead pool mm-hmm. arenas at both Mead and Powell because you're not, we don't have it. Which, so we're going to have to start realizing that it's that shared resource has, we've got to come to terms with the fact that it's not as plentiful as we thought mm-hmm. and that rain doesn't follow the plow. It doesn't work that way. That led us to the Dust Bowl and the Depression years. Doesn't happen. And we have to be cognizant of that. More extreme events will happen. Less our past histories of climate are not our future.
Right.
And within what we did with the L-Temp, we tried to recognize that as much as we could, understanding the patterns that were starting to emerge. But until you change some of the structures that are in law, in particular the compacts, saying we can't deliver that much water because we don't have that much, there's got to be some recognition of that, and there's got to be a whole lot more in terms of the conservation arena. I mean, we're fortunate at Grand Canyon because we have a dam that controls the amount of water that goes through. So that river, until such time as Lake Powell and the Upper Basin can't deliver, it will have water for all of those purposes downstream. But I think it's another one of the societal recognitions that you can't just pretend it's not happening. Mm-hmm. I mean, you look at the recommendations for development in southern Utah based on the water source Utah's allocation of mm-hmm. Colorado River and putting another straw in Lake Powell. It's like, yeah. Is that really the most reasonable thing to do?
And the Upper Basin wants to take they're not taking their full allocation
right.
yet, and
right.
they still want it.
Right.
California's taking more than their allocation, and they want to keep taking more, and everybody wants more, and there's
right.
less.
Right. And
we haven't come to terms with that yet, have we?
We haven't. And Colorado is doing they seem to be more realistic about what's going on. California, I mean, they've got some of the most stringent requirements and covenants for water and recycling and all of those other things to minimize. I mean, you get fined, I mean, if you're using too much. I mean, they've taken it on, but then you've got some of the other basin states, and Utah's a perfect example. It's like, well, we're not using our allocation, so let's put a straw in Lake Powell, and let's build up the Arizona Strip and send water over to St. George and,
right.
and increase those communities. It's like, that's not a very good idea. Oh, and let's build some more golf courses while we're at it, because after all, they don't use a lot of water. And I'm a golfer, so I like it, but it's like, this isn't necessarily the best place to do it. There's got to be a reality check, and it's troubling to me as I sit in these meetings, and it's almost like they've got blinders on. Praying for rain, yeah, absolutely. And if we build it, it will come, and it's like, no, that doesn't work either. Not except if you're a national park, if you build it, they will come. But for the
right.
most part, it doesn't work that way. And so I think it's that reality. And I think within the adaptive management program, there's not a lot of adaptation that's happening. Mm-hmm. And I think that was the problem the first time around.
Yeah. You mean before the LTEMP or before?
In the first record decision, as
okay.
we developed 96. This adaptive management program mm-hmm. in 96, we didn't adapt a whole lot. We kept
right.
doing the same thing.
Right.
So we went into LTEMP with some other tools mm-hmm. That we're hoping that you're hoping will actually help.
Mm-hmm.
Whether or not we have all the tools we need, it's hard to say. But one of the problems with this sort of construct is that you've got stakeholders who have staked out their territory and aren't necessarily going to be as flexible as we might need them to be mm-hmm. in the face of changing environmental conditions.
Mm-hmm.
We built in as much as we could, but despite the fact that we were under the Obama administration, there is still a lot of restriction as to what we could build into this and what we could do.
Mm-hmm.
I know that some of the scientists and certainly some of the stakeholders would love to see us do high flows with patterns that are different than what we established in the LTEMP.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was a compromise in LTEMP. We got the best we could, mm-hmm. given all of the stakeholders and all of the interests, for a certain set of flows that we think will at least stabilize, if not improve, conditions. But switching to a spring high flow rather than a fall high flow,
mm-hmm.
for example, when you run the numbers on sediment, If it's sediment triggered and it's got to come out of the Paria, we don't get a lot of sediment in the Paria in the winter.
Mm-hmm.
And
because your flash floods are in the summer, and that's when you're getting the sediments. So
exactly.
You do your high flows in the fall, and in the natural river regime, right. That's when you had your low flows.
Right, exactly. So it's triggered wrong. If we had, if we didn't have the dams and you had spring melt and runoff, sure, it'd be great. But we don't have that, which is why we had to stick with the fall monsoon-triggered events rather than a seasonal trigger, which to all of us makes sense until you run the numbers on sediment inputs, because that's not when you get them.
Yeah.
So, I mean, those are some of those difficult compromises that we had to address. We don't have a system that's naturally flowing. We have a dam-controlled system.
Mm-hmm.
So how can you reinstitute process in a dam-controlled environment?
Right.
And, you know, within the Park Service, I mean, we are all about trying to reestablish natural process. Our management policy is replete with all of the things that we need to be doing to maintain these systems. But when you've got a dam that's controlling the flow and controlling the sediment, you have to make those adjustments so that you can reestablish process as much as possible given the constrained system that we have. And that's the compromises that we had to do in order to get this next 20 years of adaptive management and the LTEMP done.
Yeah. Well, if the last 20 years is the new normal, it occurs to me that all of the work and programs that have been done so far are based on trying to modify how the hydropower managers let water through the turbines. I got my reservoir levels wrong earlier.
Yes.
It's flipped around. It's about 37% in Lake Mead,
right.
And it's closer to 50% in Lake Powell. But it's quite conceivable that Lake Powell, as you hinted at, might be at dead pool sometime in the next 10 or 15 years if things keep going like this, and if we try to keep Lake Mead from going to Deadpool, because there's so many cities and agriculture dependent on that water there, that we may not be generating hydropower. And I'm wondering if you've ever thought about what we would do here in Grand Canyon National Park or as a nation through the Adaptive Management Program. What new opportunities and challenges? I mean, on the one hand, there wouldn't be any funding mechanism left because we wouldn't be generating hydropower at Glen Canyon Dam.
Right.
But on the other hand, suddenly you have all kinds of other options in managing river flows if you're not saving it for hydropower. What, do you ever think about that?
Oh, yeah. Of course.
Really?
Of course I do.
Tell you.
Because we would be basically to run on the river alternative, which was in the first EIS, by the way. We had a run on the river alternative.
You did?
Yeah, we did.
Wow.
So we
thought outside the box.
We did. We were quickly told we couldn't do that, but we did anyway. So if you're basically at a scenario where you're not generating, you're at dead pool, it's kind of a run of the river. We all have suggested that solar and wind, because you've already got the electrical system up and running,
right.
That you retrofit up at Glen Canyon and Navajo Generating Station for wind and solar.
Right.
I mean, let's face it, it is incredibly sunny in this part of the world, and it's also incredibly windy a lot of the time.
Yeah.
So you've got an opportunity to actually generate differently.
Right.
It's not as nimble necessarily, because at night you aren't doing solar.
With storage, it'd be even more nimble.
With storage, you could.
And that's
that
now
technology,
affordable.
Right? That technology is there. So it's kind of like, let's stop pretending and let's start looking at retrofits, because the distribution systems are there. So in my mind, it's not that much of a stretch to say we need to start looking at how we retrofit, because indeed, we all rely on electricity. There, and by the way, the electricity here at the park comes from the coal-fired Cholla power plant.
Cholla power plant?
Yeah, that's where we get our anyway.
In another 10, 15 years, that will probably be closed down.
Yeah, but it's like, let's look at alternate sources.
Uh-huh.
And we included some discussion of that in the LTEMP.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the power companies need to, and Western Area Power in particular, they need to be able to look at other sources.
Mm-hmm.
But in this part of the West, I mean, I'm sorry, but the state of Arizona, what is with the state of Arizona and not understanding
that
we need to be going solar?
Right.
I mean, come on. Corporation Commission, it's like, what the heck? So, but we need to go there,
uh-huh.
and we're going to have to go there.
Yeah. How would that change things here on the river and with the adaptive management program?
You know, I think that if Glen Canyon Dam became run of the river, we're not generating electricity, it's going to basically end up stabilizing itself.
Could you get sediment back? You still have the dam there, and they're not going to take the dam out.
They would probably end up having to do some sort of bypass. It'd be interesting to see. This is going to be beyond my lifetime as to when this happened. It'd be interesting to see how they would do this.
Uh-huh.
Because if you're back to run of the river, you're basically opening up the side tubes and the bypasses. You're bypassing. Mm-hmm. So sediment would start flowing naturally through there. It would start happening. So you would start having sediment back in the system, and then I could be in my pre-dam self saying, there's tons of sand, everything's buried again, not to worry. So it would stabilize the system in all likelihood. So you wouldn't have the daily fluctuations, you wouldn't have the clean water, the sediment starved river, which is picking up sediment to go downstream, because all of a sudden that river would be a run of the river and it would start running all the way through with a sediment component, so you'd have reductions in that erosion and water would be warmer, our native fish would be back in a habitat that is more conducive. You know, we may not have...
Poor wallapai would be buried though, wouldn't they? The wallapai are already complaining about every time there's a high flow event, experimental event, they get more sediment and they have to go dredge out and they have, you know. They have a lot of problems with that.
They say that, but they also forget about the fact that it actually picks stuff up too and moves it to Lake Mead. So,
well, they're at the upper end of Lake Mead is what they're talking about.
I know they say that, but they keep forgetting about the fact that the high flow actually moves stuff out as well. It opens up channels. They kind of forget about that piece. And all that sediment would come down anyway. It's the other piece they forget is that all that sediment, it's going to come down there anyway. We're just trying to get it up on the beaches to have it stick around a little bit longer. It's all going to end up down there anyway. It's just a matter of when. And in a given year, it's the same volume of water, it's the same amount of sediment. And the part that, again, they keep forgetting is that we're actually holding it in Grand Canyon a little longer, the high flows. So they're not, it's a fallacy.
Yeah.
And no matter how many times you try to go through this, and Paul Grams at USGS has been a good one to try to explain this as well. He and Kendra are the two masterminds with Katrina for that HFE
Kendra
stuff.
Kendra Russell.
Yeah. And you've already talked to Paul, I suspect. Oh. You haven't talked to Paul?
Paul
Grams?
Who?
Grabs at GCMRC.
No.
He did his dissertation work on... he was one of Jack Schmidt's students.
Grams?
Yeah.
G-R-A-H-A-M-S?
No, G-R-A-M-S.
G-R-A-M-S. Much easier.
Yeah.
GCMRC.
Yeah. But Paul did his dissertation work on all of the sediment stuff.
Okay. I'll put him on the list.
Yeah.
Actually, that's a good segue to one of the last two questions. And one of the last questions is, the two last questions I have for you. One is, who else should we talk to? Another is, what would be your advice to new members coming onto the program who don't have the institutional memory that you have? How somebody who's new and coming on, how should they approach their task to be successful in your mind?
For new members coming into the program, the first thing I would want them to do is read the Grand Canyon Protection Act and understand what it is that we're trying to accomplish.
Okay.
Why we have a Grand Canyon Protection Act and what are the goals of the Protection Act. Not from your specific agency's perspective, but what does the law challenge us to do? And then with that as a framework, how does your particular stakeholder's interest align with that? If it doesn't, then why are you part of the program? And that's, I think, one of the most difficult pieces of this. At the last AMWIG meeting, the Park Service was asked to give the stakeholder perspective as to why are you part of this program. And when I got the request, it was, in my mind, it's like... because it's the Grand Canyon Protection Act. I don't think we really need to say much else. But what came to me is that many of the stakeholders don't understand the history of why we have a Grand Canyon Protection Act, why it was passed, what it was intended to do, mm-hmm. and then why the particular stakeholders were brought together to collectively work on implementing the goals. Mm-hmm. So that's the biggest piece for me is what it, why we have it, what it says, and what is your particular alignment. And if you can't see yourself in it, then why are you here? Because as I listen to a lot of the stakeholders, it's all about water
protecting their interests, and
seven basin states and our water allocations. Like, okay, that's great, but there's this section of that starts out the Grand Canyon Protection Act that identifies clearly the protect, mitigate adverse impacts to, and improve the values for which Grand Canyon and Glen Canyon were established, blah, blah, blah. Where do you see yourself in that? And that's, you know, it's kind of a purist, and maybe it's a little naive and idealistic, but it's like everyone there, and the reason why we have an adaptive management program is to fulfill the promise and the obligation set up in that law.
Yeah, I suspect a lot of people think their job, their duty, is to advocate for the interests that they represent first and foremost. And the whole point of the adaptive management program being created by the Grand Canyon Protection Act is sort of peripheral.
Right.
And you're making a very articulate argument that that's not the point. The point isn't to represent your interests. The point is to be a collaborator in a process that achieves the goals set out in the 1992 law. Yeah?
Yep. And theoretically, each one of the stakeholders should see their role in it.
Mm-hmm. As contributors.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's why it was developed the way it was. But I think that in the times that we're living in, there's folks who aren't necessarily acknowledging or seeing that they have a role in that forever business.
It's possible that an effort to create a collaborative, adaptive process to achieve a clear goal like that, more or less clear, maybe a little ambiguous, might fail. Do you think it's been relatively successful, or do you think that it's been more unsuccessful than successful, but we should keep it going and tweak it and make it work better?
So the first 20 years of the Adaptive Management Program is under our belt. We've had some successes. We're seeing resources rebounding. So by nature of the fact that we're not seeing degradation as much, the same degrees, we're seeing native fish rebounding. I mean, those two things right then and there suggest that we've been successful. We've also been successful at maintaining the collaborative. People are still at the table.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the biggest parts of that is making sure that those dialogues still continue, that you actually are still engaging, that you're not going back to your separate corners, you're actually still coming together. So if the only success is the fact that the process continues and the dialogue still happens, in my mind, that still is a measure of success. And as we move into the next 20 years, if we can continue seeing the positive gains with our native species rebounding and continuing to the way they are, if we can continue seeing stability within the nearshore environment of the canyon, if we can actually implement some of those things, we're going to see, I hope, continued improvements and stability of the system. Again, that's another success. So I think that our track record thus far has been a success, maybe not as much as I would have liked to have seen, but we're still on a positive uptick in mm-hmm. terms of resource conditions. And the fact that everybody is still at the table, nobody's walked away. So those things, in my mind, represent successes of the program.
I think it's a great place to stop.
Excellent.